Green. Okay. Green's good. Hi everyone. I just found out that one can do PI to rack in 7 minutes. Not obeying all the speed limits, I have to admit. Yeah, I know. But someone could have timed me with a stopwatch, you know. Okay, so I don't know if there's any questions left. You probably caught a few mistakes in my notes last time. At least someone did. And I'll sort this out and what I give to Joseph, I guess, to put on the slides. There's one thing that I meant to tell that I didn't tell, and that's a recent paper that I haven't actually read myself yet, by Marek Szukowski and others, on the principle of information causality. And I don't know if you'll go through that, or I find that very interesting. Because we had this, we saw that we take Bell's inequality and we violate it with quantum mechanical states by a maximum of 2 square root of 2, whereas the algebraic expression of this quantity S could actually be 4 in a general theory, right? There's no constraints. And in fact, if you introduce other special non-local devices, as they call them, you can actually saturate that bound, the 4. And just last summer or early last year, some people, and I only know it's Marek Szukowski and a few others, Marek Szukowski I know personally, found that this bound can be, or is implied or logically equivalent, that I don't know, with a principle they call information causality, which means that if you actually had a device that was, you know, that gave you a larger value than 2 square root of 2, it would allow you to sort of access more information. So you still cannot signal. So that's one of the main conclusions of this whole business of entanglement, is that while we have these correlations, we cannot use them to transmit information, right? Whatever we do on one side does not affect any outcome on the other side. So that, I mean, the reduced state, we know if we have a maximally entangled state, then the reduced state on one side will be maximally mixed. And obviously, no matter what you do, that maximally mixed state will always stay a maximally mixed state. That is simple enough, and you'll realize in your, I don't know, career, if you meet local realists and other spooky people, that they don't realize that. So every year I get at least one or two emails that say, oh, I found a new way of exploiting EPR correlations to signal, and can you check this proposal, can you check that proposal? And now they found out, Koski and others, that while you still cannot signal between, in this domain between 2 square root of 2 and 4, you cannot signal, but it would allow you to access, if you had a database on the other side, it would allow you to access an arbitrary bit. How is that more than one how is it an arbitrary bit? Well, that's something anyway I would recommend, because that has been something that's been puzzling physicists for a long time. And today it's going to be very experimental. So for those of you who are experimentalists, it's going to be maybe a little boring, and for the others, I hope it's not too detailed. At first, I'll start out by saying, or trying to point out how we have Bell's inequalities, and they represent abstract concepts of a local hidden variable theory, something that we don't even know exists. And we'll have to connect these quantities in our expression to something we measure in the experiment. And that's something we always do in physics, but in this case, we have to be especially careful. And then I'll go a little bit a historical route to talk about early experiments and Bell's inequality and the problems that come out of these experiments and how they're overcome by making additional assumptions that don't appear in the original hidden variable theory. Introduce another inequality and talk about detector efficiency, talk about our space experiments and the locality loophole, and then a few more things. And I'll see how far I get with that. So we had this diagram of a very generic EPR setting where it's a very abstract setting where you have some elongated apparatus. You inject the go signal, and it tells you, yes, I'm ready. And then you inject two signals at the ends, and you get two signals out. Okay, that sounds very simple. And if I had this box as a black box, a long black box, I could do many runs of that. And in the end, I could collect a list of numbers, and then I could do frequencies, simply relative frequencies, and I would equate these to the probabilities that I declare in my hidden variable theory. If I have to translate to a physics experiment, then I find that the scheme that's been used most here is that we have some kind of source that emits particles, and these particles meet some kind of analyzer on each side, and then they get detected. So then very often, at least in the optics domain, there's a separation between analysis and detection. We'll see one example in the end where it's not so. And this is a slightly different language. So of course, in real life, many things can happen in between here and there. And yet, this picture is still extremely idealistic in a sense, because in real life, this looks a lot worse. You have lots of pieces that make up this experiment. And clearly, the experimentalists among you know that each of these pieces is far below your expectation or what you would like to have as a device. And as an example here, there is a big polarizer. And in fact, at this time, this was Clausen's experiment in 72. These polarizers were huge, this big. And things are downsizing now, but in fact, it looks not so different yet. There's another little anecdote on the side, which has not much to do with that. But taking this approach and going in the other direction to the even more abstract, you can formulate this whole business of Bell's inequality tests or non-locality under quotes, a word that I don't really like to use, as a game. In fact, there is a bet going on which hasn't been settled yet between statistics person Accardi and another statistics person, Richard Gill, who's more on the physics side, where Accardi bets that he can simulate EPR Bell correlations on a computer. And the simulation is supposed to go as follows. You just have two computers, and they can be connected in the beginning. And at some point, you separate them. And these gentlemen here, these agents, essentially ask the computer a question. They give an input, and they expect an answer. And then they do their own correlation. And in the end, you wonder, can a computer program violate or produce data in response to these questions that can violate a Bell inequality? And of course, as physicists, we would answer no. However, there is very noted. I mean, this person, Accardi, he's a very apparently, that's what Richard tells me, it's a big shot in statistics and probability theory. And he's, to this day, convinced that he can simulate it. And with a colleague of his, they actually put out a piece of code, which is not available anymore, and I don't think I actually saved a copy, where they claimed that this would simulate the correlations. And then I downloaded this code at the time. It was in 2001. And it basically, it was a little neat little program that gave you two lists of numbers, and then when you did your analysis, you found that it violated Bell's inequality. And then had an option where you could give the program the settings, okay? And it was actually two pieces of a program so that you could run them on separate computers. And so I think I was probably the only one in the world who actually tried this and gave it two separate lists of numbers. And of course, it failed miserably. It had no, the program had no clue how to produce the correlations once I gave the settings. And that was that, I think, was the main area. It's easy to produce a program that spits out something that is correlated in an, you know, like an entangled state. But as soon as you give someone else the freedom to choose what they ask, you fail. And I think that's the essence of this whole bet scenario, is that you don't allow communication between these two parts, which is equivalent to the locality criterion. And you can read there's quite a few articles on the archive on that neat little business here. All right, so back to physics now. We had the inequality, same one. So we look at the scenario where the source spits out the pairs, and then we analyze, and we detect, and we build this correlation function out of these probabilities. And you already notice something here. I jot down p plus plus p minus minus. But what I measure here in this setting, which you know this is the way it was done a long time ago, I actually have I don't have a plus and minus. I only have detection and non-detection. So here's your first shortcoming, okay? This setup does not correspond to this theoretical expression here, where each of my analyzers should actually have two outputs and give me a binary answer. This one only gives me an answer or a non-answer. And then people make assumptions to try to map this to the theory, and we'll see what assumption that is, I guess, in this case. Or I can say it. I mean, the assumption here is that if I put my analyzer in direction alpha, it will measure, say, the plus. And if I put it at 90 degrees from alpha, it will measure the equivalent of minus. But then that's an assumption, right? You assume that your polarizer is, I guess, the same. The stuff that's normally absorbed is also the stuff that goes through when you rotate it by 90 degrees. And for the longest time, that had been an assumption. And the first experiment was done in 1980, so about 15 years after Bell's inequality, that overcame that problem. So then, in the experiment, let's say we get these numbers somehow, we correlate them with our S, and slightly different format here, and then if we plug in quantum mechanical values, we find the violation. Okay, that's our setting. So still quite abstract. Now, in experimental terms, what we have to do is assuming that quantum mechanics is right. See, here's a problem. A local realist could never do a Bell inequality violation experiment. Why? He would simply choose a state that is not entangled and say, oh, see, it doesn't violate Bell's inequality, so it must be all right, then, our local hidden variables. Okay? So, and there's, I think this is a neat example. I mean, of course, someone could come and say, oh, you really have to try out all states. But how do you try out all states? Right? You could try, of course, you could try a random sampling. Joseph knows a lot about random sampling from from these spaces. You could try random sampling, and then maybe you as a proper local realist, you would convince yourself that if you sample over all states, you know, unbiasedly, then you would find violation in some, and that should actually be discomforting enough for a local realist that there is some violation, right? However, I mean, usually people do these experiments who think that quantum mechanics might be correct. So we choose states that we expect to violate the inequality. And if we find a violation, then we can be convinced that there's some form of Bell's theorem that nature actually produces these correlations that local hidden variables cannot produce. And if we don't find it, we usually search for the experimental error. But it's an interesting problem, a philosophical problem, as to, you know, what are your assumptions or what are your biases when you go into doing such an experiment. So we produce these entangled states, and ideally we would have our source put out a ready signal. And that hasn't actually been done, as far as I know. Then we have to collect these particles, and in some cases that's a major problem because they can go off in arbitrary directions.
Yes.
Just because it would be nice, because then you would have, I mean, this would be the number you divide by in order to calculate relative frequencies.
Only if you have a, if you can get on-demand production.
It's just kind of the same, yeah. If you're 100% sure that I'm pushing a button, you get it out, then yes. On demand is an interesting question. You know, if it's 75% on demand, is it good enough or is it not good enough?
So this ties into this question of detector efficiency ultimately.
Yes, it does.
I guess they're not familiar with yet.
No, that will come up. That will come up.
So you know, Gregor mentioned that it's comfortable that you guys drop them questions.
Well, I meant that if you had a source, or I'll repeat the question. You asked, what does it mean to be 75% on demand, right? And so what I meant is that if you had a device that spit out photons or photon pairs when you push a button, then you have to allow in real life for finite efficiency. So I would say you push a button, and is it really 100%? Is it 99% of the times? And so the question is the ready signal, meaning I have put out a particle, is that it's not logically equivalent to having an on-demand source with a finite precision, right? Those are two different things. And in the Bell experiment, we'd rather like this one than the on-demand with finite precision, I think.
Do you think it'd be worth mentioning right now that one of the big issues people who want to cling to local realism is they claim that, yeah, sure, you violate Bell's inequality with your statistics, but you had a bunch of missed counts, and so maybe the observed events aren't representative of all of the events, and that's why. So this is why this is an issue.
Exactly. So collecting the particles used to be an issue. I mean, it has been in the past. It has been separated out from the efficiency and quality of your detection, but you can throw it in or not. That's sometimes a matter of taste. Now, then you have to analyze the particles. And we'll see that, you know, now that when we do experiments with visible photons, this is all easy. Okay, the analysis is probably the best part of this game. But there's other systems where this doesn't happen at all. The question is, can you analyze randomly? And we've already discussed the question of whether we even have random numbers. And then you detect, and I guess the first and foremost problem with detectors is that they're not perfect and they miss events. Talked about problem nowadays is that in some sense you want to do these detections simultaneous and not one and then the other long after at the same location, but we'll come to that. And then another thing with detectors is that sometimes, or quite often, they don't catch counts, and sometimes they give you counts that weren't even there. Okay, both of these things have to be treated. And then in this ideal scenario, we detect and then we record the values locally. You have to ask yourself, when is the recording actually done? When has the measurement happened? That's a question that comes up in terms of the time and the locality. And then if you do this, you can save the correlation, you know, for later. And in fact, my data is still here on IQC servers, and this would be a nice assignment. We could use my data from 1998 to do some calculus. Yes.
You said we want randomness in our analysis.
Randomness in analysis, in the sense not in the precision or the outcome, but we want randomness in the setting of the analyzer, right, in the direction, or in this parameter, whatever parameter you use. Now, we've already discussed some of the problems here. One of the problems is that the hidden variable theory, we require of the hidden variable theory to have for each event a value ready for any possible measurement we do. However, when we run the experiment, in each run we only do one measurement. And the thing that you do with the hidden variables has therefore sometimes been called a counterfactual argument, because in fact you won't be able to measure these other things. And yet, the idea of realism is, I guess, the very idea that you prescribe these other values that you haven't measured, whereas quantum mechanics says that unmeasured values really have no meaning. Whether they exist or not is yet a more philosophical question. And so when we do the statistics of the experiment in the end, we sum over columns of data where each point is really a different run of the experiment. And so questions of ergodicity and things have come up. And I guess people like Richard have tried to deal with those issues. When people say, well, you know, if my hidden variable theory has memory, like if I allow it to know what happened before, can I be better? Can I make my hidden variable theory be better because it already knows what the last 1,000 photons showed on detection? And it turns out they cannot. But that's not a really easy proof. Okay, it's something as a physicist you would like to assume, but it's a mathematical statement in the end. So then, here's our problem where the efficiency comes in, right? It's two things. Somehow I have to normalize. I want to have relative frequencies or probabilities. What I really measure in the lab is just a count. It's a number, a big number. And that big number has to be translated into something smaller than one by some consistent procedure. And so we wonder how should we do that? How do we treat cases where we measure neither the one nor the other photon? Do they even matter? Can we exclude them from the experiment? Right? Because in most cases, what disturbs us is that we find a count here and none there, okay, an unpaired one. The ones that we don't see at all, for us, they're usually as much as if they hadn't been there in the first place. Okay? That's a question I'm not even going to deal with very much. And then another thing that came up, if you have analyzers that have two channels come out, it happens that you'll have a count in both. So now you have a fourth value. You have the plus one, the minus one, the no detection, and the double detection. So that's yet another problem. What do you do with those? Do you throw them away? Do you randomly choose one of the values as an outcome? It's your pick. That hasn't bothered them so much up until now. I once heard a comment that. In the end, what I think it's fair, if you actually just throw dice and choose a random value for the two, you can only reduce your correlation. So in a way, you're not trying to cheat in that case. So I think that can be done consistently. All right, and then since I'm going to be talking a lot about photons, I want to go back and analyze. I think the question has come up even. As to what physical systems can we even look at to produce these correlations. And it's not only photons, but I'll list here a few advantages and disadvantages. When I talk about low-energy photons, I mean things that we can see or nearby, you know, between ultraviolet and near-infrared. That is low-energy photons. And in that range, we have very good analyzers. We have extremely good polarizers. We can do interferometry. We can do magic things. We have good sources. The detectors are relatively poor compared to other things. And another advantage we have is we can use not only the polarization degree of freedom, we can use the frequency degree of freedom or spatial degree of freedom. And all of these are available and have been used. Experiments have been done with high-energy photons, mostly out of positronium annihilation, meaning that each of the photons has 511 kilo electron volts, so that's gamma rays. And when the positronium compound decays, then these clearly there was a, if that was in the singlet state, then the photons also have to be in an angular momentum singlet state. They will also be directionally correlated if the momentum of the positronium was zero initially, and therefore they can be reasonably connected. However, analyzing the polarization of a 511 keV photon is a pain. It works through Compton scattering. In some kind of target. However, it's not very... So you analyze the scattering angles, and it's slightly polarization sensitive, but it's not very good. And so in order to argue about Bell's inequality, you have to make a few... You have to jump a few hoops and just trust that, you know, this polarization really, you know, was that polarization. Question. That's a very good question, and I don't really know.
That's,
I mean, we
water.
Exactly. We do, well. I mean, poor is relative. You know, poor 20 years ago meant 1% efficiency and lots of dark counts. Now people are working on superconducting detectors, and you can either make them fast or you can. Right now, I think it boils down to you can either make them fast or you can make them efficient, which would then be, and I'll talk about this at the very end, so-called transition edge sensors, which can be very efficient if you play some tricks. And then they become a little slow, which brings in the other problem again. And in the end, I would say it's the energy of the photon. It's just a small energy. And if you have a lot of energy, it's easy to detect. And if it's a small energy, then there is noise that you have to compete with. Now, I think many people have also been disturbed by the fact that most experiments have been done with massless particles, photons. And so it's good to know that other experiments have been performed as well and suggested as well. Most notably, there have been proton-proton scattering experiments like it's shown here, where a proton beam hits a hydrogen target. And so there's certain angular conditions that I don't even understand. Well, I understand them, but I can't really explain them. And so on the certain angles, one can find good spin correlation, and then measure that spin again by scattering in the carbon target with very, very finite precision. And please.
So you said people worry that most of these experiments are done with massless particles.
Yeah, some people. Neutron scattering. That would be excellent, except that, I'll say why nobody's done neutron scattering, and that's because getting a sizable neutron flux is really painful. You need a big reactor for that. Sure.
At a theoretical level, has anyone looked at formulating a well-type inequality for continuous variables? So for
Oh yes. There's I just saw a paper maybe 3 weeks ago or so. Maggie Reed is one of the names, R-E-I-D. People have been developing Bell's inequalities based on continuous variable measurements, but most of the time it goes like that. You measure something, and then you take some kind of parity of it to create a dichotomic variable. And then you use regular Bell's inequalities. And it appears to me that that's not the smartest way, because now you have some kind of continuous measurement, and you ought to be able to do better than just picking a bivalued observable. So it turns out we can construct much more complex Bell's inequalities if we have multivalued observables. So I think something's still to be done there. Now, and the next question is going to be how efficient this, because we hear that the detection is very efficient, right, when we do homodyne measurement. Exactly. So now comes the problem. Once you start, when they specify efficiency for continuous variable detection, I don't know how many here really know this business of quadrature measurement on optical fields. For those who do, when they specify efficiency, they really mean, say, if they say we have 99% efficiency, then they mean that they can distinguish 100 photons from 101 photons. Okay? It doesn't, which would be good enough for something like a parity measurement. However, the trade-off is usually that if you want to be very efficient in that case, or precise, I would rather say, also your measurement takes a lot of time. Because you have to have whenever you do it fast, I mean, I guess Alex Lvovsky in Calgary is the master of doing pulsed or fast continuous variable measurements, and you just specify a bandwidth then, and over that bandwidth you have a certain resolution. There's a trade-off. The faster you make it, the more your precision goes down. Yes.
How fast is fast?
For those, I think typical. Typical measurement bandwidth would be maybe on the multi megahertz level, but not very many megahertz, 2 or 3, meaning that you need at least an integration time per point of a microsecond, say, or which is quite long, you know, in photon lifetimes or coherence times. All right. No. That would be nice. No. You would have to imagine a beam coming at you with a very low average excitation. some kind of state, which would be what they call a twin beam or an EPR correlated state, where the noise is anti-correlated in two different quadratures. Let me know if there's too many technical terms here. But anyway, you measure this noise, and in order to measure the noise amplitude, which really gives you the information about the statistics of the state, say whether, you know, how many photons are in there, in order to measure that noise, you need to run an amplifier, and you need to run through a filter chain that has a certain frequency bandwidth, and that frequency bandwidth by Fourier relation corresponds to certain measurement time. It doesn't mean that during that measurement time you have millions of photons. You would only have a few.
There's correspondence to that frequency, the actual physical times.
Exactly. No, that's exactly what I wanted to point out. That usually when you go very efficient, there's some kind of time trade-off. Except, of course, if you jack up the energy of your particle to begin with, I think. And also, there's still being experiments done, and I just checked this out a few days ago. The latest papers are only from 2008 or so on correlation, measuring correlations in a... There should be a bar on here. I'll do the bar with the laser pointer, okay? It's a B0, B0 bar decay of the funny Y, whatever this is, decay. And in that case, it's essentially a flavor oscillation. So the funny thing is that they do the analysis by basically analyzing decays that happen at certain distances from the origin, because as the B0 bar, the Bs are produced in an energy eigenstate, which is not a flavor eigenstate, and therefore the flavor oscillates because it's produced in the superposition of flavors. The flavor oscillates as it propagates, and therefore, depending on where you analyze it, you analyze in a certain flavor basis. Analyzing mean that it decays into something else, of course. Okay, that's the analysis. That's as far as my high energy physics knowledge goes. So I won't. And B is the B meson. Who knows what the quark content of a B meson is? The charm and no one here? All right. No, then I'm good. I'm good then. I was hoping someone. Do you know?
No, I don't have my particle. Yeah, we'll look it up.
And this is quite interesting. Of course, they do have the same problem that they have very few counts, right? They analyze 1,000 events perhaps if all goes well for all the bases, and that's kind of tricky. Same for K mesons and I think maybe another system that I don't remember. Okay, and then in the end, what I'm still going to talk about is that experiments have been done with trapped ions, very massive particles, large ions, and those are a bit of a different kind, and we'll see how they. There's something that keeps popping up here. I don't know what it is. All right, so. Let's talk about sources before we talk about detectors and other things. The first source that people came up with is essentially a cascade decay. There's quite a bit of physics in here. That's the level scheme of calcium, a part of the level scheme of calcium. And it turns out that if you are able, by some optical means, to excite your atom from this level to that level, it will rapidly decay to here, or back down, and then when it sits here, there's only one major decay route, which goes via an intermediate level to the ground state, emitting two photons that are both kind of, this is blue, and that's green. Okay, this laser is 532 nanometers, and that'd be 551 nanometers, and this is 423 nanometers, so that's blue. And it turns out that as you look at the spin, at the angular momentum of the system, it goes from an angular momentum 0 via an angular momentum 1 to an angular momentum 0. Okay? And if we split this up into the z components along some kind of quantization axis, which has to do with our observation direction in that case, we find that there is two possible decay paths. The center one doesn't exist via the m equals 0, because that would correspond to longitudinal polarization. So these are the two circular ones. So if it goes from 0 to 1, 0 to minus 1, it has to emit a photon with a certain handedness. And if it, then it goes from minus 1 back to 0, a photon with the other handedness has to come out. And likewise here, except that these were the red or the green photons, and those were the blue photons. And so you will always have a green photon of one polarization direction, one handedness, and a blue photon of the other one. Okay, but you don't know which. Okay, as long as there's no magnetic field, these levels will be degenerate. If you put it in a magnetic field, you would destroy the entanglement in that sense. I mean, you couldn't recover it then. You would destroy the entanglement because you destroyed the indistinguishability. One issue with the source is that you have this atom. It's kind of heavy, calcium. But still, when it emits two photons, or actually because it's heavy, it can absorb a lot of momentum. So you never know. If one photon is coming out here, the other one might be coming out there. And that's an issue because inherently in the source, you won't be able to capture 100% unless you had 4 pi detectors, which you will never have. So now that's the collection efficiency issues. It turns out that these sources give relatively poor count rates, even though clever engineering by Alain Aspect and pumping, exciting this with a laser instead of just a lamp, actually brought them up to levels that aren't bad at all. So in the 70s, they had about a tenth or a few tenths of detected pairs per second, whereas then later on, they had up to 100 pairs per second, which is quite reasonable already. So let's look at this experiment essentially the first, usually quoted as one of the first dedicated Bell experiments. You have this calcium oven, and then you excite the calcium atoms with light from an arc lamp. And then you take the photons, the blue and the green. So in this case, they chose to analyze the blue photons on the left and the green photons on the right, if I have it right. And if a blue photon had gone to the left, they would have just filtered it out. Okay, so they just chose to filter one on one side and the other one on the other side. And then they had this polarizer, and that was an interesting polarizer for the physicists among you, a pile of glass plate polarizer. So if you take a glass plate, you know that the reflection at Brewster's angle will be polarized. And then if you stack many, many of these glass plates, what goes through will be very little attenuated of that polarization that is not reflected. Okay? The one that kind of... All right. So, but it's a big thing, that polarizer. And in the end, they found a violation of the inequality. And there's one thing that comes up here that we haven't talked about. Here comes the word coincidences. So what do we mean by coincidences? Well, clearly the efficiency of all of this, the photomultiplier that they use, and all this, these optics in between, is very poor. So of all the photons produced here, the photons that arrive there are probably 1/1,000, or maybe even worse than that. Okay, so that means that when I find a photon here at PM2, the probability that I also find its partner at PM1 is probably less than 1 in 1,000. Okay, so how do I actually know which to take? Because if I take all the photons, I'll essentially find no correlation because they're just unpaired. So then one trick, of course, is that physicists often do. If you want to find the needle in the haystack, you do correlation. You do what we call coincidence analysis, and you take these pulses that come out of the detectors. You inject them into a circuit that essentially only accepts when there is a pulse from both sides, and we call that a coincidence. Good. So now there's also accidental coincidences. What does that mean? Okay, those are coincidences that would even be there if these two photons came from completely independent sources. So I put a lamp here and a lamp there producing the same fluxes in the detectors, I would also get coincidences because I have to impose a finite time window on my acceptance algorithm here, right? I'll say, well, if within 10 nanoseconds I have two detections left and right, I will call this a coincidence and accept. And clearly, if you take this lamp here and that lamp, you put two detectors, there's a finite chance to get that. And that is usually called accidental coincidences. And they've been a problem. Because if your loss is high, then the accidental coincidences are a problem. If your loss is low, they're not a problem. Because then your true coincidences will be the majority. And so you will see experiments where people have been subtracting these accidental coincidences in order to find the correlation. And that's, of course, illegal. Right? You can't, I mean, it's illegal in the sense, in the view of a local realist. That wouldn't be allowed. So what do we do with the coincidences? Because we haven't said yet how we relate this to the Bell inequality. And so this is just a kind of a protocol of doing this. So you choose the settings, you count the events, and we normalize. In order to get a probability from our count rate, you know, ideally we would take the count rate where we have both pluses and divide it by the total number of pairs. But instead, what we'll do is we'll divide it by the total number of coincidences. Okay, that, you know, if we were to measure something else, that would be a totally legal procedure. However, if you're a local realist, you won't like that because exactly of what Joseph said. Well, you're ignoring all the events that didn't have a partner or that didn't actually make it to either of your detectors. And so this transition here takes an assumption. And the assumption actually is an assumption on the hidden variable theory. We will assume that these photons are controlled by hidden variables, and we will assume that the detection probability is independent of the analyzer direction. And that's a very strong assumption, if you realize that, right? Because I could easily imagine doing a hidden variable theory that just, you know, looks, the photon is so smart, it looks at the direction of the analyzer and then it decides whether it wants to be detected or not, okay?
It's not obvious how that would help you if I started to like write a program to cheat that way. I mean, the whole problem is symmetrical, right, about measurement direction.
Yes, it's true, but of course you can, if your photons, if your hidden variable in one instance are good for measurements in certain directions, so you tell both photons, oh, if you measure along this direction, you better get detected because you'll be the right correlation. But if you get measured in other directions, we don't know so well, so don't do that. In absolute angles. That just means that they won't be detected, right? And in fact, you should then be able, I mean, depending on how smart that hidden variable theory or scheme is, you should actually realize that in you know, depending on the absolute angle, you should see maybe variation in the count rate or so. But then you know that when the efficiency is low enough, it's very easy to construct the hidden variable model that does it. So you don't even...
You've never done the exercise.
Okay. Philip Pearl is the first person to realize that could be done. And there's a paper by him. I think it's Fizrev D, long time ago, early mid 70s or so, where he explicitly formulates a hidden variable theory that exploits this what we call detection efficiency loophole. Okay, we call this a loophole. So now, experimentally, this is what we do, sort of extrapolating from what we can measure to what we think should be realized in nature. And I already said this thing about the accidental coincidences. So in some early experiments, in some of these experiments on, just a second, on proton scattering and so on, one needs to subtract these accidental coincidences, meaning you would subtract from n plus plus, you would subtract an n accidental in each term here in order to actually get the correlation strong. John?
Can you just comment a little bit about the choice of A prime B prime? So what's the in a physical experiment?
Well, there's different directions of the, say, a polarizer, and A is this. A prime is that B is, no, that was B. A prime, B, and B prime.
I'm really stuck on this issue of how a local hidden variable would beat this this assumption, because I mean it's the relative angle between Alice's measurement and Bob's measurement. I mean,
the hidden variable theory violates the assumption. Right? I'm assuming that the hidden variable theory doesn't do that. I'm assuming it's fair.
No, you're assuming, but
if it's
how
biased.
How about a constructive hidden variable theory, a local hidden variable theory that could...
That is biased, and I wouldn't notice it?
It would biased so that you would violate the inequality, but only because it's not fair sampling. So what Philip Pearl did. I guess I'm not seeing how knowing the absolute angle of Alice's measurement is going to help the photon of Alice decide whether or not to be more or less likely to be detected, because it seems that what the photon would need to know, and maybe I'm just missing something, would be to know the angle at Bob's setting, which would be non-local information.
I think if you tell the photon you only be detected between absolute minus 20 and plus 20 degrees, in all other cases you disappear, and you tell the other photon you only be detected.
So restrict to relative angles.
Exactly, and then of course if that model is poor, it should be detectable. That's the point, right? So I think it'll take a little. It has to be a little smarter.
Oh, and it could also, I guess, still be rotationally symmetric, because they could say on the first event,
exactly,
these angles,
exactly,
and the second event.
Exactly. So on average, it would be, but then it would have to be smart in order not to show any bias in small samples, right? That would be. Okay, so one way out of this is, or not a way out of this, but a small improvement is what's called the Clauser-Horn inequality, and I should have put the reference here to that. So can we replace this fair sampling assumption by a weaker assumption, in essence making our statement stronger? Right. If you have a theorem based on weaker assumptions, then it would be a stronger theorem if the conclusion is the same. And so we'll start from a different version of the inequality, and it's this: you have the same p's that you had before, except that now we actually bring in some p's that are really just single sided. Okay, so they are, in experiment, these would really just be measurements on one side. So they're not coincidences whatsoever. Don't depend on a coincidence window or anything. And you can calculate this inequality quite simply. But it still has the same issue that here you have probabilities that are coincidences in the experiment and some that are not. So if you don't introduce any extra thing, you will, with a weak detector, never be able to violate that. It'll come in the end what the boundaries are for that. And so now we introduce another assumption, another auxiliary assumption, the so-called no enhancement hypothesis or no enhancement assumption. And here that assumption says the probability of a particle to detect it behind an analyzer, or so after passing an analyzer, is less or equal than without the analyzer. Sounds very reasonable, doesn't it? But I'll give you a counterexample. If I had a pen. So just showing that it's not entirely automatic. Imagine light going through a polarizer, a horizontal polarizer. Okay, so here comes H. And now we have another polarizer that will pass vertically polarized photons, meaning that when light is horizontally polarized, really nothing comes out here. Okay, nothing's transmitted there. So now I bring in. So here I have a situation where I have zero probability to detect a photon there, and this is my analyzer. Let's think that this is part of the detector here. So now I bring in another polarizer at 45 degrees, and suddenly I have, if this was, I don't know, if this flux was P, here I have P over 2, probability of getting the light through. Okay? So, in fact, the detection probability there was not independent of, say, the position of this analyzer. I mean, this could be the preparation that the hidden variable produces. And suddenly, this thing somehow signals or somehow interacts with the thing to produce higher probability. Okay, we can't speculate about hidden variables without restricting them. And yet, it's still a bit of a weaker assumption than a fair sampling, I suppose.
Photo detectors generally aren't polarization sensitive directly, like the
except maybe the meander nanowire detectors. Right? And of course, generally they aren't, but they could be. And it wouldn't have to be polarization, it could be the hidden variable. So it's not
the point is that you have found a counter example.
Exactly. So now what we do here is once we assume this, it turns out we can derive a new inequality that now only has rates that are coincidence rates, so correlated rates, where now I put this thing in the symbol infinity there to mean that the polarizer has been removed. Okay, so we measure something where either on one side, each, or on both sides, we just take out the analyzer and only have the detector there. And it turns out that this can be useful, but it's just as difficult to violate in the end, or almost as difficult. So going back to this idea of the scheme where we had in contrast to our assumptions that our apparatus would actually give us either of two values, a plus or a minus. In most cases, most old experiments, we only had an analyzer and a detector that said yes or no. The particle's there or it's not there. It was Alain Aspé, here on the top right. Forget about the right experiment for a start. That comes a little later. He managed, and this was his first. I actually don't have a picture of that here. Too bad. No, that's actually it. Yeah, that's the two channel. What, the two? Yeah. So here's this experiment where this is the experiment where he introduced a laser in order to pump to excite the source, meaning that he got a lot more counts and could do experiments much faster. And on the right is a setup where he actually has two channels. There's a bit of a problem here because he doesn't actually use one analyzer. That's a different experiment. I'm confusing myself here. That's one where he uses the modulator to switch the paths. So he had one where he had a polarizer to measure both outputs, basically a birefringent polarizer. And so he did a whole series of experiments in short succession that improved many things. One with the two channels. One with the improved source, one with two output channels, and another one when he introduced fast switching. But I'm going to go back to that in a second. I just want to say that then a little later came the dawn of a new series of experiments that is continuing to the day in this building even, where instead of using an atomic source, we use one of these nonlinear optic sources, and I'm going to explain that in more detail later. It just happens that with these sources, what's improved so much is the directional correlation compared to the atomic sources. But now there's a chance, at least in theory, that we could catch all the photons. If we have one photon on this side, there's at least a theoretical possibility to catch all the photons on the other side. So now for the first time with this kind of source, and I'm going to explain it more, you have the chance of actually getting to 100% detection efficiency if your detector is 100% efficient. Whereas in all the previous ones, you didn't even have that chance. So what is it with that fast switching? We look to Bell again, and there was a comment by John Bell after these first after the first series of experiments. This is also in Bertelmann's Socks and the Nature of Reality, where he writes that it's, where does it say here? Some would like to suggest quantum mechanics may be wrong in sufficiently critical situations, meaning if the detector efficiency is very good, maybe quantum mechanics is really wrong. On the other hand, he says that already at that time, the experiment seemed to be very convincing, and he wouldn't believe. It seems that John Bell originally was more leaning towards local realistic theories, okay, and found himself in a situation that the experiments seemed to go the other way. And then he said, you know, that some people would say that maybe it is only that the detectors are not efficient enough, and maybe then we would find that quantum mechanics is wrong and local realism is correct. On the other hand, it says that it's not very likely that quantum mechanics works so well for so many other things, and suddenly here we have something where all the regular extrapolation that is based on efficiency fails so dramatically. And so now, he says, of much more importance, in my opinion, is the complete absence of the vital time factor in existing experiments. The analyzers are not rotated during the flight of the particles. And so if you assume that there was some communication going on between the hidden variables out of such a pair, that communication could be entirely slow and allowed by relativity, and it could explain the quantum correlations. And he already says that Aspey was working on this experiment, and that's the one here. So here, Alain Aspey, instead of taking these huge polarizers and rotating them fast, which is clearly impossible, the time it takes for a photon to go, this experiment in the end was about 10 meters long, or longer, 10 meters, I think. And so for one photon to go from the center to the outside, 5 meters, that's about 5 × 3 nanoseconds, 15 nanoseconds. So clearly nothing massive can be moved in 15 nanoseconds.
Hire more undergrads.
Very strong undergrads, too. But they're good as random number generators, at least on exams. So he had the smart idea, instead of moving the polarizers, leave the polarizers as they are, but take two different polarizers and send the photons either way with a fast switch. And that switch worked by essentially creating a standing wave in water. And then depending on how strong that standing wave is, you can diffract light at that standing wave, at the refractive index profile that's produced in the water. It's called an acousto-optic modulator that he actually built himself. And this way you can deflect the photon or not deflect it. And depending on whether it's deflected or not, it either meets this polarizer or it meets that polarizer. And it is polarization independent in water. That's why he did it in water. But you can buy these devices in crystals in which they are much more efficient and much faster. However, they are very polarization sensitive. That's the whole problem. And in fact, that was a good part of my PhD thesis, was finding switches that are either polarization switches or polarization independent path switches. And turns out the latter is harder to find. Okay, so this was a space experiment. There was just one, I guess, I mean, this in the end, it had data, but as Alain Aspey himself told me, it was kind of at the margin of significance, in his own words. Also, there's one issue here, and that is that the signals he used to switch these paths were periodic signals, okay, of different frequencies on each side. However, a periodic signal is perfectly predictable. So while you rotate the analyzers, a reasonably smart hidden variable theory could calibrate that rotation out and know which way to go in each case. So then came the demand, well, you should really switch this randomly. It turns out that doesn't work at all with these AOMs there, or at least with this AOMs it wouldn't have worked, because you can drive them very nicely on a resonant frequency, but not very well with a random signal that has a large band. And so at about in the mid-90s, when these down conversion sources that we saw, these nonlinear optics sources, had become kind of a standard tool in the labs, multiple people started to work on improving on this. And then Wolfgang Kittel in Geneva and Nicolas Gisant's group did an experiment where they increased the distance dramatically. And I think to this day, this is not the longest anymore nowadays, but it is still a huge distance between these two ends of the experiment that were actually in different villages near Geneva, separated by about 11 kilometers. But you notice one thing here, and that is that so there's the actual analyzer setting is given by the phase here of this interferometer. I won't go into the details here. And then that phase can be set only very slowly. Essentially, you do this by temperature changes to the interferometer. Okay, they heat it, and then something stretches, and the phase changes. It's very slow. In fact, in the experiment, they don't even heat it actively. They just let it free run. Okay. So heat variable. Exactly. very nice experiment. There's another problem here, and that is that it takes the signals with these detectors, avalanche photodiodes, and then sends the signals back to be taken as coincidences in the middle. So here's a bit of an issue. If you were to believe that this system is still quantum mechanical, then the signal is basically propagating back, and your distance has evaporated. Okay, now of course that's, I wouldn't go so far, but I have actually had some visitors in Innsbruck who've asked me, you should really do this experiment differently. You should really record on each side. And I said, I'm doing this. Oh, really? Well, then my theory doesn't work anymore. So this was the idea behind that experiment in Innsbruck, where I'm back now. Now I'm in this building here. And So we managed to put a source, one of these down conversion sources, here in the basement, basically of the cafeteria, and then one experimental station here. I call it Alice, and another one Bob, on the other side, separated by about 400 meters in a straight line. And why would we do this? Well, Bell said he didn't like that the analyzers weren't rotated during flight. But what do we really mean? What do we really mean when we say we want to enforce the locality? And quite a bit of thinking had to go with this. And this is what comes out. And if you have any comments, I'll be happy to comment on that. In the end, we want to do two measurements in A and B. And these space-time regions A and B can be influenced by anything that's in the backward light cone by subluminal signals, okay? And the common influence can only come from this intersection N here. Clearly, your source, the source that spits out the particle, is always in the backwards light cone. So clearly, the hidden variables will be distributed to, if they're even stuck to the photon, right? The hidden variables could actually live anywhere. It doesn't matter whether they're on the photons or not. So this is the one thing. Now we turn this around and view this from a source perspective. So here are the world lines of Alice and Bob. Now what's important, and what in our opinion what was important, was that let's look at the measurement. Okay, here's at the end of this red double arrow here. That's the end of a measurement. Now you're going to ask me, when is the measurement done, and I can't really tell you. Is it when it's when it's an electrical signal? Is it when it's in the hardware that measures the time? Is it when it's in the main memory? Is it when it's on the hard disk? And in fact, unfortunately, at that time, hard drives were too slow. And actually, even nowadays, I don't think it would work. Maybe with a solid-state disk. But the problem is that when you write to a hard drive, you first write to a buffer, and then some random time it actually makes it onto the disk. So you don't know when it makes it onto the disk. So in our case, the end of the measurement was when it was in the main memory of the computer. Okay, so that was just what we could do. And then you have to think about what do I have to do during this? I mean, how much time do I have available? And so we go back. we take this end and we draw a backwards light cone from here towards Alice. Because what did we assume for locality? We assumed that it was independent of the parameter on Alice's side and that it was independent of the outcome on Alice's side. Now, the outcome produces the lesser of the problems, right? The outcome occurs later. So that's easier to beat. What you have to beat is that whole process of choosing a setting has to be contained in that or outside that backward light cone, which I guess is the white area here. Now, since the source is always in the backward light cone of both of these, it doesn't actually matter how fast these particles are. And in our case, the photons were actually guided in an optical fiber, meaning they have really 2/3 of the speed of the vacuum speed of light. Okay, so there's an issue here. I said something before about simultaneity. There is a bit of a problem here. If one of the paths is much shorter, you're always bounded by this one, right? It's the easiest situation if they are symmetric. That's the easiest. But other situations are okay, so they're not included here. Here's a slightly more complicated layout because if I were to draw a space-time diagram of that, it would look a lot more complicated, I guess, because the fibers, of course, didn't go straight. So the effective speed of light is even slower. How am I doing? Oh, I'm already done. If you have to leave, please leave. It'll still take a little while here. Now, so the cables actually went quite a complicated way, and it turned out that we had to buy a certain cable length, and you never know how much you need. So in the end, it turned out that we had still quite a bit on the spools. But where do we put the spools? Do we put them at the end, or do we put them in the center? So what do you think? Does it matter? Yeah, I think center. But what happens if I put them in the center is that in this diagram, I essentially move this back here. If I put them out here, I think I have an issue. Because then the photon's already there at the measurement site, hovering around, waiting for whatever influence comes in. Okay? So there's a little detail here.
Again, you only changed one of the two settings on one side, or did you?
No, both. It was completely symmetric, the experiment. That was another thing. Totally symmetric. So here's our source. Couple the light into fibers. Here's our switches. I'm going to say something about those. They're EOMs, polarizer, two detectors, some electronics, a random number generator driving that switch, an atomic clock on each side to keep the time. And otherwise, these are completely separated. Just a master computer to, please.
Really long pseudo-random number, or how?
Well, that's, I don't know. We'll get there in a second. Okay, and one of the more important things, and to this day, this experiment still the only data that's there to be evaluated as long time lists. So let's look at the details. The source. Now, many of you already know the source. How many know the source already, down conversion source? Do I need to talk about this? Yes? Do I need to talk about it, the source? Or have you seen, because we're running out of time, so maybe I'd skip that. But if you, no, well, I'll talk about it, okay? So we use nonlinear optics. That is when we do electromagnetic waves in the medium, any medium in the real world is never perfectly linear. If you hit it hard enough, it'll do something funny. And same with most transparent media. If you hit them hard enough, they do funny things. For example, they can start mixing frequencies. So if you have three beams here, these will mix. So maybe if omega 1 and omega 2 are excited, and omega 3 will be produced or amplified. Okay. And quantum mechanically, that means that we can send in a blue photon, and with the help of this medium, it can split into two red photons. And if we do that smart, those two photons will be entangled. Those photons are actually not that weak. How do I do this now? I have to move this over. Okay. See if this works. Wait a second. I'll just do this again here. I have to click here. No. All right. I'll show that after. Okay. Let's go. So, and when you arrange it right, it turns out. So we send blue light through this crystal. This crystal produces pairs of photons. And the top photons here in this top cone are vertically polarized, the bottom ones are horizontally polarized, and with a little bit of trickery, we get this entangled state out. Okay? It's very established by now, so I don't want to spend too much time on that. And at that time, you know, things were still a little bigger, so it looked like this. And nowadays, you go and look at Chris's source or Denis's source, and it's much smaller and much better. How did we do random numbers, random bits? Here's a light-emitting diode sending light onto this beam splitter, two photomultipliers, amplifiers, and a circuit that toggles between 0 and 1. That's random bits. A bit of cheating here in my speech, because the most of the randomness is actually in the arrival times of the photons, not in the... It's very hard to make this unbiased from the start. It's very hard. It'll always be a little biased. But what we were after is not the bias, not the zero bias, but the autocorrelation time. So essentially, how if I take the value at a certain time, how likely is it that I get, say, the same value or the other value, it doesn't matter, at a certain time later? And we measured this, and we found that we could get this to less than 15 nanoseconds. So after 15 nanoseconds, the probability was down at, I guess this is the one sigma level. So if you wait multiples of this 15 nanoseconds, you're totally at zero, uncorrelated.
If I understand correctly, in principle, it's like the randomness of measuring a quantum superposition that's at play.
Yes.
So it's not some kind of deterministic algorithm that generates pseudorandom numbers.
Exactly. It's a completely physical random number generator. And there's a separate paper about it in review of scientific instruments.
So you're going to go, if you believe that quantum events are random, then with a few caveats.
See, here's the problem, right? If you have a conspiracy theory that says the same hidden variables control this device that control my source, then I'm in trouble. Okay, these devices were at the ends of the measurement of the thing. So Alice station, Bob station. Of course, if the hidden variables control this, I'm out of luck. And then my freedom of choice assumption is not fulfilled. okay, so here speed was the issue. Now, of course, the distance, the straight distance between the source and between the two ends, the straight distance was about 360 meters. That corresponds to 1.2 microseconds. So there's a bit of leeway there, right? But I wanted this to be not borderline, but far. So that those times had to be a lot shorter than that total distance time. Of course, the distance was also just given by the size of the campus. Okay. So here's the switch. It's a big thing. It's a crystal, essentially. And if you apply voltage, it rotates polarization. So it's quite simple in that way. It turns out there's some interesting things here. This thing would go up to 30 megahertz, okay, which is much slower than those 15 nanoseconds I had from the random number generator. So I couldn't actually drive this directly with the random numbers, with the random bits. You know, it would just fry if I did that. So I had to sample the random numbers at some regular interval derived from the clock. And then some additional trickery, because when it switches, you don't want to measure when you ramp through. Because it takes 10 nanoseconds to go from one state to the other. During that time, you're not quite sure what the phase is or what the polarization setting is, so you want to blank the signal in that time. And just a few days ago, I got an email. Oh, I analyzed your data, and I found some funny dips here and there. And I'm, oh, my God, what is that again? And, of course, there's so many ugly things going on in the electronics that this will haunt me forever. What's interesting is, though, you can. What I want to say is you can find much faster switches that switch in a nanosecond or actually less. However, it turns out that if they are, you typically can't run them very often, because if you switch them all the time, they also fry. It's just whenever you want to do something fast, and all the time, things get hot. There's always dissipation. So, but after doing all this, we take these numbers, we record. What we do is we just record the arrival time of these photons. Right, here's the two detectors, and we take a measurement that just records the time when the photon arrives, which detector it came through, and which analyzer setting was applied, one of two. Okay, and because that gives me these four curves here. What are the curves? The parameter on the horizontal is the bias point. So I could only switch between two states. I guess I could have done a little smarter and switched between multiple states. But, you know, two states I thought was enough. So I switched basically by 45 degrees on this side and by 45 degrees on that side, just that the sort of the absolute alignment of these two pointers, I could vary separately. So here is something where it's essentially fast switching between the red and the black and the green and the blue here. Okay, that's the switching that occurs. Sure? You can still decide. Even now you can decide. How did I decide? we did histograms and just looked at how wide the distribution was. And then you make it wide enough so that your result doesn't depend, you know, in any large way on the width of the window. I think if you squeeze it very tight, then you can essentially vary the correlation value that you get, and you don't want that. So you make it big enough so that it doesn't play a role. I think that was my strategy, but it's a good question. And people have made different choices for that. So and then that would be. That would maybe we could draw these curves all into one thing. These are the four possible outcomes, right? Two different settings and two different results on each side is four different correlated outcomes. And then I can also vary this bias here. But for one violation of Bell's inequality, I only need one of these settings here. Okay, I don't need to do a slow variation to measure Bell's inequality. Now, in more in numbers, here you see actual numbers, and you can judge the efficiencies from that too. This is the count rates without taking coincidences here at ALICE, about maybe 100,000 photons in each channel. Not the same for all of them, if you notice. Same on Bob's side, and then and you see the angles too: 0, 45, 90, 135. And for Bob, it's the same thing, shifted by 22.5 degrees. And then this is the coincidences. Of course, those are much smaller than the single counts. And in fact, we had about 5% efficiency overall through the long fibers. Not that bad. So here you see the window, 4 nanosecond. Please. Slightly different detectors for the most part. But coupling to the fiber is also never, you know, it's you play with it for so long and then.
The experimental setup is not symmetric.
Well, it's not perfectly symmetric, but some of that asymmetry is really just experimenter's skill. Sometimes, right? Or how long you want to spend tweaking it. That's a bit of an issue. It could also be simply that, you know, one of the fiber connectors, you know, has a little bit of dirt on one side but not the other one. So perfect symmetry is never achievable. And then you get the correlations. That was really nice. I mean, we got really, really, really nice values here. Also, when we try to look at what quantum mechanics would have given us for the same thing, it's also consistent with that. There's always two things in a, that's also something I should point out. When you do this experiment, there's two things, right? One is the violation of Bell's inequality, where all the assumptions go into the local hidden variable theory. And the other thing is it actually consistent with quantum mechanics? And that's sometimes just as hard. Okay, so, after this experiment, I don't know how long you want to stay, so feel free to go if you have to go, okay? I have a little more. And that is, we talked about freedom of choice, and I just flashed this. I don't know if it's actually been published properly. It's only on the archive. And really, Thomas should talk about this, not I. Because they actually did an experiment where they implemented freedom of choice by sort of locality. And what they did is they took this random number generator that I, in my experiment, was really on Alice's side and on Bob's side. They took it and moved it away from Alice's side. And the same on Bob's side. On Bob's side, it doesn't actually matter, I think. Okay, and so now, if I have the space-time diagram here, and you have to look at the zoom pictures here, the choice of the setting occurs is space-like separated to the source point, which means that if you believe that the hidden variables are somehow tied to the particle, then they couldn't have influenced the choice. But I hear that they had a lot of trouble getting this published, because there's probably a lot of philosophy behind that. Because we already said, right, if the hidden variables in the original assumption are anywhere, they're not necessarily tied to the particle. And as soon as you assume that they're global, I think moving the random number generator doesn't really help. That's one of the issues here. So now let's look just for a few more minutes into the other loophole, which is called the detection efficiency loophole. I haven't introduced the efficiency yet of the detector. Efficiency, we usually use eta for that. And if we look at that in an ideal case, then the experimentally detected probability will be reduced from the expected probability of 1/2 by eta. And then, of course, if I detect on both sides, it'll be eta squared. Okay, so now I plug this into my inequality, and I take the SH the CH inequality for convenience. It works with the other one as well, but the CHSH. And I can calculate in just a little line that at the optimal settings here, eta needs to be at least 82% in order to violate this inequality here, okay, with where the singles rates are. 82% is really hard, because even though our detector by itself doesn't have 80%, right? It has maybe 60-70%. And that does not include any transmission losses on the way. So 80% overall, or over 83%, is really tough. Now, there is some tricks to get a bit of a break here. And that is, one, Philipp Eberhardt found that one can use non-maximally entangled states and some kind of appropriately chosen angles to get down to 2/3. That's already something. And then quite recently, in I think 2006 or 2007, people looked into what happens when you allow the efficiencies to be very, very asymmetric. Imagine you could detect one side with almost unity efficiency, and then what can I do on the other side? And it turns out you can drop that to 50% and even a little lower with some extra tricks. So here we had something about photodetectors. We already mentioned that. But typically, we only get, this is how our detectors typically look, and they have 60%. And then Zhang's made others that aren't much more efficient, but other people have made superconducting ones that are quite efficient. However, then they become slow, and then so far this doesn't look very good. And so it's maybe good to know, or comforting to know, that people have looked into doing this with trapped ions. So here's an ion trap, and I'm cheating a bit here because this experiment was done in Boulder, and that experiment is in Innsbruck. And In Innsbruck, they've also violated Bell's inequalities, but unfortunately, they don't have a. They were just a little slower with that. and here with the ions, some of the things are interesting. So the way they do this is that they. This is from their paper. They call it magic box, but let's just forget about this. They prepare the two ions in an entangled state, essentially by doing something like a C naught, or I mean, some kind of manipulation, and then. Rather than sending them through some kind of analyzer, they rotate them and they always analyze them in the same state, which is pretty much what I did with the polarization. Rotate the polarization and leave the polarizer invariant. And then the tricky thing is that now the way they detect the state by sending in laser light and scattering off the atom. And it turns out that if the atom is in the up state, it scatters a lot of light. If it's in down state, it scatters no light. So in a way, this is a bit different from having an analyzer and a detector. Here they do a measurement and they find out which state it is. Except there's one caveat. The ions are 3 microns apart. I was going to show it, but then I realized I can't show 3 microns. Okay? They're really, really close together, meaning that they couldn't even optically resolve one from the other. So what did they actually measure? Well, they measured the combined state of the two. They measured whether both were dark, both were bright, or one of them was bright, which is enough to take the correlations that you need for the Bell inequality, okay? Because we need the P++ plus the P minus minus, minus the P plus minus, and P minus plus, and the P plus minus and minus plus are here sort of lumped into one measurement. And this is what you get. This is some examples. Here's an example where the case where one is bright is the most probable one, so I guess an anticorrelated case. Where rarely two are bright and almost, and also rarely zero are bright. And this is another case where things are a little more equal, or maybe you could say it happens more often that two are bright and zero are bright together than that just one is bright. Okay, and so they do this for different angles, and they also find the violation of Bell's inequality. Here's their values. They're significantly larger than two. Now, from my personal experience from talking to local realists, they're not, they're almost ignoring this as experiments because they basically say, well, this is one thing. 3 microns is not a distance. So what are we going to do? How are we going to do a real experiment? So far, we haven't had a real, decisive, conclusive experiment. In the end, I think I'm a little undecided. I used to think that we would do this with very efficient photodetectors. But right now I'm thinking that maybe it's more likely that something like this happens. This is an actual experiment where an ion was taken in a trap, sent out a photon, and then this photon was analyzed far away by Chris Monroe. Okay, so you have entanglement between the state of the ion that you can measure and the state of the photon that goes out. Even more refined, one can think of two ions in two remote traps that get entangled by interacting them with light from an entangled photon source, or by actually measuring light that comes from the ions either way. Because in that case, you would have the ions far away. They would be entangled, and you could measure them at any time. Okay, so you have no locality. I mean, the locality problem is just the same as in my experiment, if they're far apart. So I think... Well, I don't really know. We'll see who wins. I'm not sure. Both of these would be really cool. Please.
So when Richard gave the introduction of two people with a predetermined strategy, have a certain probability of winning or gaining, but if they share an entangled source,
build
if,
this.
If you believe in Bell's theorem, why don't you put your money? Set up
this game. Yeah. How would the gambling industry like that? They would like that a lot. It's true. And in fact, I should say that there's IDQuantique, a company by Nicolas Gisin. They build random number generators based on this beam splitting principle, quantum random number generators. And the main buyers of these are makers of gambling machines. Okay. So that idea is not maybe not that far off, except that I think people are putting a lot of money into that already. But having these ions in a little trap is still, I think, a little way out. Or just even just taking, you just take the photons. Yeah, if you had them, I guess, yeah. Right. Yeah. But yeah, you can do that. Yeah, you can do that here. I think some of you have done the experiment, right? So that's the conclusion. We have a lot of evidence, convincing evidence, you know, of either case, with local arrangements and with good detection arrangements. We don't have both. And whether there's a big conspiracy that prevents nature from behaving quantum mechanically if you achieve both of these conditions, and then who knows, maybe someone comes up with another problem, is unknown, and it's an exciting story. We'll see how it goes. Thanks.